everyone, and welcome back to the 16mm Film Crew. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Dale.
You can watch us on YouTube. You can like and comment on our YouTube videos and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can listen to us everywhere podcasts are found at 16mm Film Crew Podcast. Leave us a rating review. And visit us on our website at www.16mmfilmcrew.com. This week, we watched The Zone of Interest, written and directed by Jonathan Glazer. The Zone of Interest is a 2023 historical drama film by Jonathan Glazer, loosely based on the 2014 novel by Martin Amis, starring Christian Friedel and Sandra Hüller as the German Nazi commandant Rudolf Hess and his wife Hedwig. It follows the pair as they strive to build a dream life for their family in a new home right next to the Auschwitz concentration camp. So, Dale, you contacted me earlier because you had feelings about this movie, so take all the time you need to just get it all out.
I mean, it's kind of apropos that we're talking about this movie, and then 30 years ago, like February, like 30 years ago, Schindler's List came out, you know, kind of dealing with this very same subject matter. I mean, not just that, but Steven Spielberg and Liam Neeson did an interview with Hollywood Reporter talking about the importance of the movie and their experience with it. And this movie, in stark contrast, I know it talks, it's mostly about how people compartmentalize things that are happening in their life to not dwell on things, like even see from the parents, even the children doing it in certain situations. I do feel like, in light of how the world is currently, you know, I feel like this movie humanizes Nazis a little bit too much. It create all the movie, if it's really about beyond like the father is, you know, one of the high ranking officials in the Nazi party, you know, organizing and working in the concentration camps. The mother is mostly a homemaker with, you know, servants and stuff like that who are themselves Jews because she threatens them. Like, says, I'll tell my husband to burn you and turn you to ash. But it's really, like, about a tumultuous, like, marriage and relationships on its rocks. And I feel like showcasing that kind of goes, Nazis are just like us. They can have bad relationships, too. I'm really not, you know, feeling that vibe that this movie gives off, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, that's okay.
Yes, it's sorry. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
That's it?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think in the beginning, at least like halfway through the film, I definitely felt the way that you did. I was like, do we really need to be humanizing Nazis? Like, that kind of seems like, again, like to what you said, not the vibe. Yeah. So when I finished watching it, it was definitely giving me, like, not really Schindler's List, but more of The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, yeah. That movie. It was giving me more of that because it was focusing more on, like, the perpetrator's, you know, point of view, except it's, like, from a little kid. So, like, it's, like, a more easily digestible type of way to look at it because it's a child, so they're more, like, naive. They don't know exactly what's going on. They themselves are not doing anything, so you can kind of accept it from that point of view. But this point of view is like from a Nazi commander and his wife. Like, that is who we are watching. That is who we are spending time with. We don't really go to the camps. We don't see what's going on over there. We see other imprisoned Jews in working in their house, but you don't get like a full indication of like what is happening across the wall. You're just hearing screams and you're hearing, you know, bullets and, you know, weapons and stuff. And you're seeing smoke from, you know, the crematoriums and stuff like that. So you know what's happening, but it's like, you don't know.
Yeah.
Like, you're not spending time with them. And I thought that was a very gutsy way to like depict a film. Like, that's kind of crazy. But then I had to watch interviews because I was like, I can't, because for people to be like, this is one of the best movies that came out last year, like, I needed more information, because I'm like, what are y'all talking about? And it's not like it was a bad movie, because from like technical standpoints, it was very good. Yeah. It's just like, what is the messaging? I guess that's the question. So I watched interviews with the director, Jonathan, and the entire cast. And what he was saying was like, I put the focus on the perpetrators, because I think when people think about Nazis, they think like, oh, these people were like the most evil people in the world. There's no way that I'm not like them.
Yeah.
You know, like when we see stories about the Holocaust, it's always about the victims. And so it's easy to sympathize and be like, yeah, I'm like the victims. Like I would never be in a position to do something like this. But then he was like, you know, the Holocaust was organized by people. Like, people did that. And it's true. Like, people did do this. Like, it wasn't like some superstitious weird thing. Like, people did it. Government sanctioned it. America let it happen. Like, this, like,
this former is Nazis, you know.
This is true. So I think what he was trying to say was, like, from what I'm gathering from the interviews, is that we, not that we're culpable, but all, but we're just like, we're not so different from the people who committed these atrocities. Like, there, we have let the atrocities happen over the course of the years. We've been bystanders to these things. Some of us, not all of us, had the power, but some people had power to actually influence certain atrocities to happen. So, like, I think that's what he was trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm gathering from what he was saying, was that, like, you always want to put yourself in the position of the victim, never the perpetrator. And I guess, and also, like, what I'm gathering from what the actors were saying was that you're not supposed to feel anything for these people because they don't feel anything.
Yeah.
So, like, don't feel sympathy for them. So from what I'm understanding, it's not, they're not trying to sell you something of, like, feel bad for the people who, like, murdered millions. Like, don't, like, don't do that. But just, it's like, don't feel bad for them, but don't feel like you're completely removed from doing something that, to that degree. Or even if it's not to that degree, just doing something or being capable of doing something evil. Because I guess that's all of inside of us. That's what I'm gathering.
Yeah. Like, that's where the compartmentalization part really comes in with this movie, because in the middle of, like, I think there's one scene that stands out to me the most is where one of his youngest son, he's in his room playing with his, like, his toys, and then hears screams, and then, like, in German, they talk about, oh, they're stealing apples and stuff like that, and he goes to the window. Like, you could see him, like, processing, oh, something bad is happening outside, all this yelling and people are screaming. But then he goes to the window and he kind of glances and then he goes, eh, and then, like, walks away. Like, even a child is learning that how to disassociate stuff. And I think this is, like, the counter, the Richard Brody from New Yorker kind of said this is, like, this year's Jojo Rabbit. And I kind of do agree, because the fact of the matter is, this shows how adults can know they're kind of doing bad things and compartmentalize it. Whereas a Jojo Rabbit, you see how even, like, Scarlett Johansson as Jojo's mother wasn't pro-Nazi, trying to, you know, help him do good things. Even she got hung. Where you can see how the brainwashing in that situation affected children. No matter how much of an environment that parents put them in where they weren't supposed to be exposed to it and kept them away from it. And this movie also showcases it, because the kids are playing, like, the wall of their house is Auschwitz, basically. You know, mm-hmm. They're constantly exposed to it, where they're still trying to, they don't know how to compartmentalize it. Like, his other son is full Nazi youth regalia, stuff like that. Even to the point, yes, every older sibling kind of bullies their kid. He kind of throws his brother into the greenhouse. And he's like, oh, this is for you, you filthy traitor. Like, playing, like, this soldier Jew game where he locks his brother in the crematorium. That kind of thing. That, like, so I loved how it really exposed how it affected all levels of your family life in that.
Yeah, and how it was purposefully shot. Like, the house and the garden was so well put together. It's always bright and light in that, and whenever we're looking at their life, it's always, like, very idyllic.
Yeah.
And that was all done, you know, intentionally. Like, and also accurately. Like, that's how the real people, because I actually didn't know if this was based on a real person, because the book isn't based on a real person. It's a it is, but it's fictional, like fictional. Yeah. But this movie is based on the real person who did all this stuff. And they took all the photographic evidence and stuff, like, and recreated the house, basically. And I think they shot, like, in the same neighborhood where Auschwitz is. So they're really showing, like, for these people, they literally didn't, not that they didn't know, because of course they knew what was going on, but they purposely tried to block all of it out. Mm-hmm. And tried to make it seem like, nah, this is our perfect life. We love it here. Isn't it great? Like, there's a one scene where Sandra is like bragging to her friends that people call her the Queen of Auschwitz. Like, girl, people are getting burned across your wall. Like, what is going on? It's so crazy. It's almost like too crazy to believe that people lived that close to everything that happened there, and they just simply decided not to care about it. Like, they just decided, like, that wasn't a real thing. And you had characters who were, like, feeling weird about it. Like, the grandmother who comes to stay felt weird about it. But I'm also just like, girl, you're part of the problem. So I had no sympathy for anybody in there. Not the kids. I don't care. The only person I had sympathy for was the baby, because the baby truly didn't know what was happening. But, like, everybody else, I was like, I don't care what happens to any of y'all. Like, I don't. And so in that way, I think the movie accomplished what it was supposed to do, because I felt nothing for any of those people. But I think what was interesting is that, like, they couldn't actually block it out. Like, as hard as they tried to compartmentalize, it was still affecting their lives. Like,
yeah,
because there's no way that it can't. And I think that's the point. Like, the point is, like, even when you do evil things, like, unless you're, I don't know, a complete sociopath or psychopath, maybe some of them were, don't know, like, you're gonna feel something. And I feel like at the end, that's what the ending was trying to show, where he was, like, gagging, where he couldn't really, like, throw up, because, like, it was affecting him in some way, where he had to, like, think about the fact, like, oh, I am gassing people, like, that is, I am doing that. Yeah. Those were under my directions. And then if he went down the path to actually think about, like, all the stuff he was really doing, he would have to confront the fact that, like, maybe the people who I think are awful are just, like, regular people. You know, and maybe the things that I've been taught are all lies, but, like, if you built your life on a lie, it's kind of hard to, you know, undo that. So,
yeah, it's clear it was, like, what he was doing was affecting him. Like, people don't know, once you, like, think about being sick or feeling bad, your body kind of goes, oh, now you're sick, that kind of thing. And it was clear that what he was doing was affecting him, because you see he's going to the physician, and you see him throwing up repeatedly. And not just that, but you mentioned him, his job is basically how to create the crematoriums and gas chambers, stuff like that, and also inspect them. Like, he even says he goes to, like, a giant Nazi party, and he's like, yeah, I didn't really pay attention the whole time. I was just thinking about how to gas this whole room. Like, those most mundane thing, he's like not even there, like, to you know, associate with his comrades and stuff. He's just there thinking, how can I kill everybody here effectively? Like, disassociated to it that far, where he's thinking about killing his friends and coworkers. But I do appreciate the level of research Glazer did doing this, because, you know, he collaborated with Auschwitz Museum, got access to their archives, you know. That in those archives also have testimonies from survivors and people who actually were employed in his household, you know. Then he also like the story of Alexandria, the little Polish girl we see repeatedly picking apples. Like, that's a real story, where the prisoner, the music she finds is from a prisoner named Joseph Wolf, and he was, like, one of the first people to he survived the camp and documented one of the first people to document what happened in the Holocaust, you know. And they actually, like, the little girl was 90 years old when she met him and died afterwards. But the bike used in those scenes and the dress the actress wore were actually belonging to Alexandra. Like, wow. That level of detail and intentionality is amazing.
Yeah. honestly, like I said from before, like, this is kind of, like, one of the best films I've seen just because of how, like, everything was done. Like, when you actually, like, look, hear the interviews and stuff, of how much work went into recreating this and having the situation set up in a way where all the actors could feel like this is real, it's on another level of, like, detailed dedication, like, years of hard work. Because what they were saying was that, like, they weren't even really shooting it in the way that, you know, you normally shoot a movie. It was more like they just set up cameras around the house or, like, hid them in bushes and stuff. And then Jonathan and his team were, like, in another place watching the footage on screens. But, like, basically the actors were just in the environments, just doing the scenes, just, like, going through the scenes and kind of almost self-directing, because he didn't want it to be... I think what he was saying is that he really didn't want to have, like, it be glossy or, like, put the sheen of whatever. He didn't want it to, like, he did not want to glamorize this Nazi experience. He really wanted it to just be, like, stark, basic, like, you're just getting these people living their lives, and then you make your determinations about how you feel about that.
Yeah.
Which is such a smart way to go about it. Because I'm like, this is another movie about the Holocaust. We've seen so many of them. Some of them have been great, some of them haven't. And I just feel like if you're going to tell the story again, like, you really have to do it differently, have something new to say. And I think that the way that they did it, even when it came to shooting it, was just, like, a really smart way of telling a story that maybe you know, maybe you don't know. And then presenting it in a way where, I don't know, for me, I couldn't stop thinking about it. Like, it was just in my head, because I was like, I feel like I need more answers. I really need to get to the bottom of, like, what's going on here. Even though this is a story that, like, we've been taught. I know I've watched my own documentaries and stuff about it. Like, so it's not, so yeah, it's a burrower. Like, it just kind of gets into your head and worms around.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I think the key scene that kind of sticks out to me when you mentioned how they just had the cameras placed and let the actors go is there are certain scenes where you can tell that they were planned out, like anything involving the children. They said, all right, we're going to go here and here. But when, like, the adults are in the environment, like, the one that sticks out is the one where they're all eating his birthday cake and the baby's crying. And babies are notoriously difficult to work with on set. Like, but most movies mask it by cutting to the characters and redubbing their dialogue, you know, for what they actually want to say that they can't because the baby's cranky or something like that. But it's here they intentionally let the shot go on and had the actors adapt around what the baby is doing, you know, respond and engage in real time. So I thought that was beautiful. Like, and stylistically wise, you mentioned how the house is and how the house is a character itself. That aspect of the movie reminds me very much of Parasite, you know, where the house itself is also a character as part of it, or part of the environment as well.
Yeah, and it is, because I feel like that was a whole thing of their, like, desperation to stay there.
Yeah.
Like, the wife was so desperate for him not to leave because she didn't. And she was like, if you want to go. I'm staying here with the kids. Like, okay, yikes. But, like, and he wanted to get back there. So, like, there was so much sentimental value about that home, considering what was happening next door. I think that's the thing that always kind of brought me back to, like, reality when I was watching this. Mm-hmm. Was, like, the kids are outside having a pool party. Everyone's having fun. And you can hear, like, gunshots, people screaming. It's like, what kind of... It's just, again, like I'm saying, it just seems so unbelievable, like, that you could exist in that type of environment. Like, I don't know. Like, it doesn't make any sense to me. I can't.
But oddly enough, they're keenly aware of it, because when the son and the father go horseback riding, they pass a bunch of Jews being processed into the concentration camp. And they also... when him and the kids are fishing and swimming on the canoe and stuff, where you see the bones and the ash and the water. And, you know, he rushes the kids home to take them bath. And that scene highlights just they're aware of what they're doing, because the idea of Ash touching you, like, they even trying to blow out their nose, they're coughing up all everything. They're aware of the death they are causing, because it's like, it's kind of, I look at it like this, when you watch movies and a character like kills somebody and stuff like that, the moral side kicks in when they are trying to wash the blood off their hands. It's kind of that same thing, where he's in the bathroom showering, the kids are all there trying, and the kids are crying, and the servants and the mother like, no, we have to, you know, remove this from you. You know, we have to. So those scenes kind of do highlight that, you know, they're aware of what is going on around them.
Yeah, it's just so, that was so sick. Because it's like, this is your fault. Like, I can't, like, it's so weird. Because it's like, you're rushing to get your kids out the water and wash them. But, like, you're the reason why the ash is in the water to begin with. Yeah. So, like, hello?
Yeah, and it didn't concern
him. We gotta turn this on.
Yeah, it didn't concern him until it affected his personal life.
Right.
So...
But that's the thing about this movie, right? And I have other points to make, but I just wanted to talk about this for a second. Because it's like, I feel like we do this a lot in our own lives. And even what's happening right now, like, I'll bring it home to the Gaza situation in a second. But yeah. Like, every time you see a group that is othered, there's always like a sense of like, well, I don't understand them, so I fear them. And yeah. Because I fear them, I'm going to be violent against them. I'm going to have hatred against them. I don't care what happens to them until it starts affecting my life. And you can see that in slavery. You can see that now. You can see that in any, like, atrocity that's happened over history. Like, it's just, like, it's so crazy because it's... And maybe that's where he was going with this, where it's, like... Maybe not all of us, but
yeah. There
has been that where it's like, once you decide that a group is beneath you, like, you can literally in your mind do anything to them and not care about their humanity.
Yeah.
And then that's how you get to Holocaust. Like, that's how you get to places where true evilness is happening. It's from that first indication in your mind, well, this person is beneath me. These group of people aren't on the same level of me. So I can treat them how I want.
Yeah, and that's like what they say the stages of a genocide are. There are different levels of it. And like you mentioned, like, stuff that happened recently, like, to me, like, stuff that sticks out, like, right now, you know, the issue over in vitro fertilization. You know, when, you know, Edward 45 was president, you know, repealing Roe versus Wade, a lot of his female supporters who happen to be of a certain ethnicity were all for it, blah, 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 blah. And then when it actually happened, you know, they're marching on Washington protesting. And then, you know, Roe versus Wade gets repealed. And they're like, yay, no more abortions. You can have abortions. And now, talking about in vitro fertilization, they're like, oh, that's bad. I want to have kids. And that's the only way now it's concerned. Like, they're concerned with, until it affected them, they were perfectly fine with everything happening. And somebody brought up an interesting point about how a lot of European countries, they're kind of like, of course, their healthcare system is better structured and education is free. Somebody made the point, yeah, a lot of those cultures tend to be monoethnic, not really diverse. And somebody said the only reason that doesn't happen here is because they don't want minorities to have access. So to make sure they'd rather nobody have access, just so minorities can't have access to those things. So once again, it's touching on how stuff, we don't really care until it affects us, you know, personally.
Yeah. And it's like, and we build systems that support that.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, keep other people out of it. Like, unless you're white and straight, because I mean, like, that's what this whole Aryan situation was built on back in the days of, like, we need someone to blame because the economy is bad, so we're blaming the Jews, and then
yeah. That
whole thing kicked off. It's just like, you always, and it's so funny to me, because it's like, it's you can always say something about someone else. And then you think that if you do, or if you live by a certain code, nothing bad will happen to you. But when it gets brought to your doorstep,
yeah,
it's like, you didn't think that it would go that far. Like, you think that people's rights getting repealed won't eventually come back to you? Like, it will. Like, it just will. Like, we're seeing that right now. Like, it's just, it always comes back to you. Like, no one is exempt. Once people stop caring about human rights, like, just forget about it. Like, even if you're white and straight and you think that, like, your life is going to be fine because you fit into a certain mold, like, nah, it's coming for you too. So,
yeah.
So just prepare yourself for that, because.
What was the quote? I don't know if fully is when they came for the. It's been when they came for the Jews, I didn't say anything. And then when they came for the next people, I didn't say anything or I didn't speak up. And when they came for me, there was nobody left to speak for me. Like, it's a trickle. They're always going to go for the next group. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, back to the movie.
Yeah, of course.
I wanted to talk about the this still is a part of it, but I wanted to talk about specifically like the infrared scenes with Alexandra. I didn't know her name.
Yeah.
But the Polish girl.
Yeah.
So at first I thought she was planting bombs and I was like, yeah, set it off up in here. Like, but she wasn't. She was just like putting apples in the dirt for the people, which is extremely kind. And I really liked that you had that contrast of like those infrared scenes where she was like planting the apples and, you know, just trying to show little acts of kindness, even though that they weren't targeting her specifically. I mean, they did round up Polish people, but like for the most part, it was really just Polish Jews who were getting cremated, who were, you know, dying. But the fact that she did that and it was all in like darkness and like all of the evilness is in the light. I liked that contrast of like this young person is really risking her life just to like help out people who she doesn't know. And then she played that beautiful song on the piano. It was just it really helped get me through the movie actually, because I just felt like having to spend so much time with that family just made me really angry and annoyed. So the fact that they had her scenes kind of integrated in it really meant a lot, because it just kind of helped remind you as an audience member, like there was still hope. There were still people who were trying to help even in the midst of all that darkness. And that you said that she was wearing the same dress as the rope woman who had done that. Like, that's, and I'm sure for the people who watched it, who went through it, whose families have gone through that, like, I'm sure that meant a lot as well. And I think Steven Spielberg even said, like, this movie was fantastic. Like, as good as Schindler's List, which is, like, a huge compliment. Because Schindler's List was kind of, like, the definitive, like, Holocaust movie. Like, if you wanted to make a movie about it, like, Steven Spielberg did it.
Yeah.
So, again, like you said, it was those little details that I think really made it powerful.
And I do love how it kind of inverts it in a way, like you mentioned, like the house, the environment is white, vibrant, idyllic, full of color. And in those scenes, they kind of do the infrared, mostly black and white kind of thing, where it's from their, it switches it to their perspective. Like, oh, what they're doing is so white and pure and fine. And what she's doing, helping these, you know, Jews, is so bad. You know, it kind of, the visual contrast. But it also forces the audience to go, what is going on, and into focus. And he kind of does the same thing, because the movie is kind of broken down into chapters, like nine or ten chapters, and how they bookend each chapter is usually the black or red screen accompanied by music, and the music kind of leaves you feeling, especially the music at the end. Like the music in the beginning was kind of very idyllic and perfect, and then transition to them out, you know, enjoying the day out, and the music at the end gets fairly somber, and it is, like, in some cases the screen is red and stuff like that. So like, he made a lot of directorial choices in order to make you focus as to what's happening, what's going on next.
Yeah. And again, it's the inversion, it's the contrasting different elements that really kind of brought this movie out and made it original. The sound designer, Johnny Byrne, who also did sound for Poor Things.
Yeah.
But he did the sound for this, and that to me was like the most impactful piece of this movie, because what you're seeing and what you're hearing are always in direct conflict with each other.
Yeah.
So like, they're outside celebrating the Commandant's birthday, and behind you can hear the screams of people dying. So it's like, and it's always there, like it's always in the background. And again, it always reminds you of like what the truth is of this, you know, like I think the actor who plays Rudolph was saying that like the director, Jonathan, was telling him to, if your eyes are seeing it, if your eyes are saying the truth, then your mouth needs to be lying. Yeah. And if your mouth is lying, then your eyes need to be telling the truth. So it's like, it's that. It's like a constant back and forth of like, what you're seeing is the lie, but what you're hearing is the truth.
Yeah.
And that truth is right there. And the fact that it is true, like this really happened, it only kind of beats that point in more.
Yeah.
The more you think about it.
Yeah, and it's not just that. Like we mentioned a while ago, how the visual transitions, and you mentioned the sound design and stuff, like the intention to not have a lot of musical pieces going on during those scenes, like it puts you in that world. Like most movies, during even the most mundane tasks, sweeping your floor, there's some music going around, or people are walking and talking, there's some kind of auditory things happening. But in this movie, all that's devoid. So all you can focus on is, you know, hearing people shouting in the background, like sporadic pats of gunfire, you know, to really ground you in the moment of what's happening.
Yep, yep, yep.
Yeah.
Okay, is this where I'm going to talk about? Yes. Ties to today.
Yeah.
After I watched this movie, I watched a bunch of the interviews just to get like a grounding. Those were all really informative. I watched a documentary about Rudolf Huss. Is that his name? Huss? Yeah, Rudolf Huss.
Yep.
Watched that. Understood the real life story. Oh, God. Yeah. And then I watched an hour-long video on Palestine by a creator called Sean, I think his name is. And it's so fascinating how this movie came in so like simultaneously. Now it came out before October 7th, but you know, it was widely released afterwards. So the parallels of like, I'm not going to say the parallels. Never mind. I take it back. Take it back. FBI, take it back. If you listen to this podcast, I take it back. However, there are some things that I saw in this film and in the history of this event, and I saw some similarities between that and what's happening currently in Gaza. And it is funny because it's just like, it's like we talked about earlier, it's that same mentality of othering people.
Yeah.
And it feels, I guess, tinged with irony.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that like and it's a particular group I learned in the video of Zionist people who are trying to, from my eyes and I think most people's eyes, wipe out an entire group of people.
Yeah.
Now they happen to be in the Israeli government, so there is a tinge of irony to the fact that some of those people whose families probably went through the Holocaust, who understand suffering, are so willing to perpetrate that.
Yeah.
It's haunting, actually. It's scary and it's sad because it's like, you think, when people talked about the Holocaust, it was almost like, well, how could this ever happen in modern day? You know, it was the 30s and the 40s.
It's happened plenty of times since then.
It's happened, you know? It happened then when people thought that's completely barbaric, like that would never go down. And it happened then. It happened since then, and it's happening currently.
Yeah.
And I just feel like, And the guy mentioned it in the video. He was like, when are we going to learn like that? The suffering, the violence, like that is not a good teacher. Like it's not going to produce anything good. And it's crazy because it's just like, how can there be a history of that in your nation and people still be like blocking aid trucks, cheering for the fact that like people's homes are completely decimated, they have nowhere to go, they're starving. It's like, and that's y'all's history. It just seems so, you know what I'm saying, like it just seems so crazy that that would be some individual's next step to push that type of behavior forward, and that people who were countries who witnessed stuff like that happening co-signing it. It's just like, because that's all I was thinking about when I was watching this movie.
Yeah.
All I was thinking like, about.
I feel the same way. I mean, for me, as, you know, a Black man, be as, you know, son of immigrants, me, us, not just me, but us also being descendants from the results of slavery, you know, being in this part mm-hmm. of the world. For me personally, I will always side with oppressed people, you know, bar none. And for the last couple months or years almost since this conflict in Gaza has been going on, I've come to rationalize that when the Holocaust happened and people were saying never again, you remember when we were saying when the whole Black Lives Matter came up, it's like it's what we're really saying is Black Lives Matter too. You know, there's a silent modifier there. And how I've reconciled it is when people say never again, the silent modifier there is to us. You know, genocide, as long as it's not happening to us, it's fine. That kind of thing. That's like the Cliff Notes version of what I want to say. Can't go too far in depth, but yeah, it's a harrowing look at how people ignore what's happening around them. Like I said before, it's kind of fitting, you know, similar just came out 30 years ago, watching this movie, and like you mentioned, the timing of this movie being released as far as what's going on in the world today.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. It just made it so much more like vivid for me, you know, of like, nah, this happened, it's happening, and it's easy for people to get to the position where they can not only do it, but justify it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this was like a really, really powerful movie. Like I have not stopped thinking about it since I watched it. Cause I'm just like, you know.
And it's also funny because, you know, we have Oppenheimer as well. Kind of deals with this mm-hmm. as well. It's kind of funny mm-hmm. that the stages of genocide, the last one is like denial. And, you know, we were in a place called Huntsville, Alabama for a couple years, each at different time periods. And, you know, there is a whole, you know, missile testing facility. There is a giant arena in that city named after a German, you know, rocket scientist called the Von Braun, mm-hmm. like all that information on how, and it's documented, people choose to ignore it. Like the U.S. military and government hired a lot of these Nazi scientists, you know, to come and help them build rockets to go to the moon and beyond and stuff like that. So even the American government is culpable in, you know, this legacy of Nazis still kind of, you know, simmering now.
Oh yes, the fact in that documentary, what I didn't realize is that the Americans knew about Auschwitz. Like they knew about the concentration camp. I think they knew what was going on there, but I think they didn't think it was as bad as it was being reported to be, and so they delayed freeing it or liberating that camp.
Oh yeah,
until like 1945. But they knew in 1944 what was going down. So it's like, so y'all just, you know how many lives could have been saved if y'all stepped in when you got the information? Like,
I mean,
is everyone gone crazy? It's so weird to me. I don't understand how these things work.
Not to have, you know, Mr. Secret Agent Man you know, listening to this podcast or even the recording that we're having, you know, but, you know,
they're going to come get us.
The U.S. at the same time, you know, because of what was going on with, of course, you had like the Red Scare. Well, the Red Scare was after, but at that same time during World War II and issues with the Pacific Theater fighting Japan, they were also locking up Japanese people in the country at the same time. So I'm just going to leave that there. So it's kind of one of those do as I say, not as I do kind of situations. We can lock people up, but don't you do the same. So,
yeah. Crazy. crazy. But yeah. And so great movie. I thought it was interesting that like it kind of does hold a mirror up in a maybe not in an exact way, but slightly, because it's like, but one thing I noticed was that like all of the people in the house were like, you know, they were getting their food cooked by Jewish people, they were like taking their clothes from people who were in the concentration camps. There's this whole scene where she's like putting on fur and so you think about the fact that like what it takes for you to be comfortable. Like, are we okay with just like buying our clothes from these chains where, you know, the people who are making them are not being paid well, they're in terrible working conditions, it's slave labor sometimes. Like, we don't think about sometimes the comforts that we take for granted. And I think that that's also another piece of this, of just like how much you are willing to ignore if you're doing all right. And it kind of rolls into what we were talking about before anyways, but that was just something that I remembered. So yeah, this movie was, at first it feels, it's like a bitter pill. Like you don't like it because it's like watching Nazis. But like once it goes down, you're like, okay, I think maybe I needed to see it, you know?
Yeah, like the irony of this movie was, I compartmentalized, which is what the movie's about, you know, my dislike for them humanizing Nazis and their families and their trivial issues, you know, and but I was also aware of what the movie was actually trying to portray. So, but yeah. And also shouts out to, you know, was it Sandra Mueller between this and An Enemy of the Fall? You know, so,
icon.
Although I do think her role in An Enemy of Fall is probably better than this, but she was nominated for a BAFTA for both movies. She didn't win, though, but and she got the Oscar nom for An Enemy of the Fall. So good on her.
Great.
So I know SAG Awards happened last couple of weekend, you know, a lot of people posting pictures online, you know, my man Pedro Pascal looking like a pirate, you know, on the red carpet, you know, Ciara laced up in her brown latex, got Russell Wilson saying he gonna get her out of it, all kind of crazy stuff happening at SAG Awards. Them people.
I'm sorry. I thought you said Russell Brand. I'm so sorry.
Russell Wilson is
her husband.
Yeah, them two kind of be OD sharing, talking about their love life too much. I don't need to be knowing all that. I don't even know about that. And she already pregnant, so you know, 9 months later she's gonna have another baby anyway. But a lot of stuff happened with the SAG Awards. The big standout I know you're excited for is Lily Gladstone winning Best Actress at the SAGs.
Yes, this meant a lot to me just because I thought that Emma Stone was gonna sweep, and I was very nervous about that because even though I thought her performance in Poor Things was amazing, I think Emma Stone is great. I love her. But I really wanted Lily Gladstone. I kind of wanted this to be her year because, again, her performance in Killers was one of my favorite performances of the entire year. But Lily won last night. It was two nights ago. But she did win. And that gave me some hope. I don't know if she's going to win the Oscar. It would be so amazing if she did. But I don't know if that's going to happen. But I am glad that it's not just like a total Stone takeover. Like, I'm very happy that like Lily got something else. Yeah. She got the Golden Globe, but she also got this. Yeah. So that means something to me.
Yeah. And we also got, of course, the next phase of Marvel, or their attempt to save this patchwork quilt of Phase 5, which, you know, Marvel has scaled back with movies. They're releasing one movie this year where, you know, Sony's like F it. We're going to release all these trash Spider-Man movies. You know, Madam Web recently bombed. Well, we still got Kraven to come out. But, you know, they announced a Fantastic Four casting, you know, a couple days ago. Pedro Pascal's Reed Richards, Vanessa Kirby as Sue Storm, my boy from Stranger Things as Johnny Storm. And I don't want to miss this man's name from Chef, cousin from Chef. Yes. He's playing Ben Grimm. He mentioned, like, the suit was not going to be, like, an actual suit. It's going to be kind of CGI, which is par for the course for Marvel. They've even done that for Spider-Man. But the CGI kind of does look good when you look at Thanos and, you know, Mark Ruffalo as a Hulk. I'm okay with it. But, yeah, I'm like, the funny thing is, I think me and my friends were talking about the irony. This is fully set in 1940s America, and you have a Peruvian man marrying a white British lady. That, how is that gonna fly? You know, are they gonna rewrite this? Somehow Reed Richards is like, is he white and not actually being Peruvian? You know how that's gonna fly off. But yeah,
there's been a lot of conversation about, like, the casting for this. I've been paying attention for a few months now. And a lot of different names have been thrown around. I know Vanessa Kirby's name has been in it for a minute. Yeah. So I'm thinking that, like, she was probably attached the longest to it.
Yeah.
But I'm excited for Pedro to enter the MCU. Now, I wish we were in a better place for him to enter and do it.
Yeah.
But I think with the Wolverine, we're bringing back the X-Men situation. Like, maybe it'll be good. So we'll just see what happens with that Deadpool movie. But I am excited about this. I love Joseph Quinn in Stranger Things. He was one of my favorite parts of it. I think everyone loves Cousin. So, like, it's very, I think it's a good little grouping. So I'm at least excited about to see what they're going to do with the characters. I'm excited about that.
Yeah.
So
I'm looking forward to it. You know, they're listed as Marvel's first family. And I want to know how it's going to work movie-wise, you know, because if you think about it, if you actually read the comic books, not to talk about you, but if people actually read the comic books.
Oh, I don't. You're talking to me.
Okay. But there's usually a disconnect from the MCU watchers or the DCEU watchers of comic book and movie, and the comic book companies are kind of trying to streamline where the movie is actually canon, and they're kind of reverse engineering everything. But the issue I see happening with Fantastic Four is they're not really like superheroes in the traditional sense where you think of movie superheroes. They're more like explorers. Like, think you're lost in space. Think you're Swiss Family Robinson, you know, like Robinson Crusoe. Like, they're more in that vein. Kind of. So I want to see how that's gonna, you know, translate. And maybe that whole explorer thing, people are theorizing that, you know, as smart as Reed Richards is, and, you know, in the past movie we saw them, the Avengers time travel to get Phineas Stones, maybe that's how Reed Richards kind of, the whole family enters the modern era to some time travel shenanigans at the end of the movie. But we'll see, because especially I think now even Marvel has reported they're trying to look for a figure or a character to be their linchpin for this this phase. And that's been also been part of their problem as well. Because, like we mentioned in the past, the death of Chadwick Boseman affected them in that particular fashion. And you kind of don't want to leave Tom Holland, Spider-Man might be the most popular character. You don't want to have to rely on him to be your lead going forward for these projects, because he wants to act in different things. So
yeah, so maybe they're looking to Pedro, like, hey, are you gonna do it?
I mean, you already work for us with the Mandalorian, like, you know.
So, so yeah. So there's that. Okay, you pulled up this story about a hopeful sign for mid-sized movies. What does this mean?
Yeah, so of course we've been lamenting of, you know, the lack of broader scopes in Hollywood as far as the pictures and stuff that we're getting. And a big part of that was those mid-budget pictures where a lot of up-and-coming actors cut their teeth and stuff like that. Or we've seen, like, what's the rom-com with what's Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney, how it might have been cheesy, but it's a rom-com, they're going to be cheesy, how that has actually done amazingly well box office wise. They're talking about the Berlin film market, which kind of has been showing that a lot of non-franchise pictures with stars have been doing really well as far as being picked up, because the Berlin is the European film market. But it's kind of a good testing order for the whole indie kind of space. A lot of movies have been bought up for between $20 and $50 million, you know, some projects being headlined by Margot Robbie, you know, Will Smith. Funny, people thought he wouldn't get any more projects anymore, but Bad Boys 4 is shooting in Miami in a couple days, you know, he's getting projects here. Funny, even Dave Bautista, who's a former wrestler, but who has shown in the last couple movies that he's an amazing actor. So a lot of those projects, you know, are being picked up, you know, and it's the same. He got projects from, you know, Celine Song, that star, you know, Dakota Johnson and Chris Evans. You know, a lot of these pictures that are not burdened with the triple digit, you know, budgets, there is a sign that they're coming back into the foray, which is what the industry was missing, because it was just superhero movies back to back to back, which, yeah.
Yeah, I think I feel like last year, maybe kind of in the latter half of last year, I was seeing a lot more mid-budget movies, which were so well done and made by really great directors. So I was like, you know what? I don't know what their box office is, but I think these are pretty good. So like, maybe we, you know, our shouting in the void has actually been listened to by somebody, and we couldn't get back to that, because I feel like that's definitely so important. Like, independent film was like saving us creatively, you know, and nourishing our hearts and our souls. You know, the superhero movies were nourishing something else, but it didn't have anything to do with us. So I hope we're getting back to that. That'd be amazing. Last story. Tyler Perry hosts his $800 million studio expansion after being shocked by AI. He was seeing demonstrations of OpenAI video generator, and so he was planning to add 12 sound stages to his studio, but he stopped because he was shocked by the demonstration of Sora and its capabilities. Tyler Perry is the enemy, and I can't emphasize that enough.
Yeah.
He is the enemy to everything that film and television is supposed to be. He is the enemy to creativity. He is the enemy to other Black actors. He is the enemy.
Yeah. And it's the thing with Tyler Perry is he's a multi-hyphenate actor, writer, director, producer. He's had issues in the fore. The reason why he writes all his projects, and as much as he's tried to massage it, it's a strictly anti-union point of view, because he hated the idea of hiring writers to write, you know, 16 to 20 episodes and then reading them and saying, oh, these aren't good, I need rewrites, and then having the contract writers again. He hated that because he felt like to him it was wasting money. So now he writes everything. And you can see in his projects, clearly, I think, Meta Culpa, starring Kelly Rowland.
Why is she involved?
How
dare he involve her?
It debuted at number one in Netflix because, you know, it's Kelly Rowland. So, you know, I'm gonna watch that shit. But the issue is
was it good?
Oh, I ain't watched it yet because I'm not gonna watch Tyler Perry.
Okay.
So like, the issue people are saying with Tyler Perry has locked himself in a particular genre of course, his stage plays that transition to movies. That style does not really attract a younger audience. And so how his movies work, yes, you can hire all the young actors and act in your projects, but your quality of work has not evolved with the audience you're trying to target. Like, those church aunties are not going to watch, because these kind of sex scenes in Medicopa are kind of gratuitous, and a lot of church aunties that watch Medea are not going to watch it. But the younger audience you're trying to would target, your stories are written kind of crap, because he's writing everything himself. And it's interesting, people were saying as a as a writer and as a director, he should be against AI. But now you see the producer side of Tyler Perry kicking in. It's like, oh, I can save money. You know, he already not paying writers. He kind of does internships, I guess, with his makeup people to reduce the cost on them and give them experience. And I was like, oh, I'm about to spend almost $1 billion on property and land. Oh, I can just AI this shit and be fine. He's talking about, oh, I don't have to go on location. He's saying he can sit in his office and do this on his computer. You know, yeah, Tyler Perry is where creativity kind of goes to die. You know, so, yeah.
He is a menace to society, and I want us to be rid of him. Like, I can't deal with him anymore. Like, everything he does makes me angry. And it makes me angry because it's like, you're a Black man in Hollywood. Like, you really need to be looking out for your people, giving them good roles written by people who are better writers than you, not hiring actors to film an entire movie in 5 days. That's insanity. Like, how do you even think that you're going to get something good out of that? Like, I just don't. That's so disrespectful. Like, he's so disrespectful to every single person who's involved in this industry. Like, it's just wild to me. And so when I saw this story, I was like, yeah, makes sense. It totally makes sense that he's going to choose AI over actually, like, doing something with people, like having to actually do the hard work of making something real. Collaboration, which is what the whole industry is built on. Like, of course he doesn't want to do that. Yeah. That'd be too much work. Yeah. That'd be too much money. Like, please get out of this industry. Like, if you want to make money, go to do tech, go do that stuff over there, go into business. Like, don't mess with this stuff anymore. Like, I can't tell you how much I detest him. Like,
look, if you're a Black creative and you live in Atlanta, you've had your parents or some old person say, oh, take your resume to Tyler Perry, he'll hire you. Like,
yes, that's what my mom said.
Every Black creative has heard that. And if you're a younger Black creative,
I will never do that.
And you've had to correct them saying that's not how it works. It's not going to happen. So, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, I can't deal with this man anymore. Let's talk about what we have watched this week.
Well, you mentioned earlier we watched your Ross documentary on, you know, the person who's the main feature in Zone of Interest. I'm currently on I got to see Iron Claw before it premiered months ago. And I, you know, got the opportunity to this past week because now it's on digital. I've had the opportunity to, you know, go and rewatch it and enjoy it. I think, you know, as much crap as gives Zac Efron sometimes, I think he did a wonderful job carrying that picture. On my, like, second viewing, you still have the same opinion. If you're a wrestling fan or vaguely, you're kind of familiar with the story. But yeah, I think it's a really beautiful picture. Kind of sad it got no nominations for the Oscars. But then again, I'm not surprised because sometimes the people who pick the movies for the Oscars don't really watch all the movies that came out. They kind of watch, oh, what's the big name or what's made the most money so far. So those smaller pictures that are really artistically done, casted, and have a lot of care and passion behind it, and came a wonderful project, because they don't have all the buzz on social media or the box office numbers behind it, they kind of do get left in the shuffle. So, yeah.
I feel like everyone was talking about Iron Claw, like, in the lead up to the release. But I don't know. Yeah, I guess I don't know what happened. Because it's true, I was expecting to see it kind of more places and more awards and stuff. So, that's interesting. But yeah, I always thought Zac Efron was a great actor. I stand by that. Since he was in High School Musical.
Of course.
I saw the potential.
Okay.
And then in Hairspray, I was like, he's a great actor. Like, you can't watch Hairspray and not think he's a great actor. So, like,
the only actor I think in Hairspray that has not gotten a fair shake in Hollywood, James Marsden. If this was like the 70s or 80s of Hollywood where you had to be a triple, or even the Harold Flynn era and all those old Hollywood era where you had to be a triple dead thing, dance, act, James Marsden would be a box office star in that era of Hollywood. He's the only person in Hairspray I thought is underutilized in Hollywood to this day. And now he's left doing Sonic movies, talking to nothing, an AI hedgehog.
No, he's in a show called Jury Duty, and I feel like that has gotten a lot of attention.
Yeah.
So I think he's fine.
Yeah.
I think the girl who plays the main character, I think her name is like Nikki something. What happened to her? I have not heard a peep from her since Hairspray came out many years ago. So like, I don't know what they did there. Like, I feel like she should have been in more stuff. What happened to her?
I think it was.
What'd y'all do with her?
I think she got into some racial issue with somebody at the airport, and that's kind of where everybody's like, no.
What?
I don't know. I'm assuming. Don't take my what I'm saying as fact. Oh my
God, that's awful.
So hey.
Anyway, yeah, I did watch the documentary on Huss. Mm-hmm. That was very informative. I'm going to rewatch Oppenheimer because it's streaming, so I'm very excited to rewatch that. It's gonna be terrible quality. Like, once you watch something in IMAX and then you watch something on your computer, like, it's just.
But they're re-releasing in IMAX, though.
They are, and they're also re-releasing Tenet.
Yeah.
But the thing is I'm already going to see Dune.
Yeah.
In IMAX, so I will not be paying extra to see these movies that I've already seen.
I mean, you know.
On my love, if I was a millionaire, I'd be in the IMAX. I'd be living in there, but.
I'm gonna take it back to my high school days where me and my friends would sometimes in the summer go see 4 movies in a day by just staying in the movie theater.
You know, I used to do that too, but I got caught once, and then once I got caught, I was like, nah.
Oh yeah, that's
too embarrassing.
We got caught once because one of my homeboys was like, yo, he went to go see he split off from the group and went to go watch a different movie, and he got caught by one of the movie attendants, and because he was trying to get my car keys. And so he saw us walk by earlier in the day, and we stayed in the same theater the whole time, so they didn't see us. But he brought their attention to us, and we got kicked out. But yeah.
Yeah, it used to be a hustlers. Now you pay.
Yeah.
You want to go see a movie, you have to pay for it.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
All right, anyways, let's wrap that up. We hope that you guys are doing well. Make sure to check out all of our social media. Support us if you can, and we will see you guys in the next episode. Goodbye.
Au revoir.